First of all, a good morning to everybody, and
I'm gonna start recording here. You ready?
Yeah, okay, fine, you can start recording.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay. Today is September 14th, 2020, and a very hearty good morning to all my students. I just want to mention, as you all know, there's going to be a total lockdown. Our next scheduled class is 1 week after Sukkot ends, or at least 1 week after Yontif Sheni of Sukkot. So I hope by then we're back to what's called normal today, meaning I'm teaching here from Gruss. If there'll be an additional lockdown, I'll try to use Protexi to get to Gruss, get to my papers. Maybe I'll teach from the house. Shem Yirachem. But this is easiest and this is best, and I hope that nothing will upset the apple cart. I want to mention that, and this is quite important, all the questions and answers that come up this year are being recorded as well. We're not depending upon the Zoom, but we have recorders here. So people were worried that there were questions and important answers. They're making the rounds of YU Torah, at least later today. Yesterday's shiur raised a tremendous response. I understand why. I'm only touching upon it very quickly. I was more interested in telling the young rabbis, be careful how you sell chametz. And 50, 60 years later, it's shocking to me that what happened to me on Chol HaMoed with the authorization, had I been a lamdan then, I would have realized it's not the first time in history. Maisim b'chol yom. Halacha l'maisa, I just want to state very quickly, because I don't want to leave this till after Sukkot. I'll mention Pesach, people won't even know my name then, but now they'll remember yesterday's shir. And Charlie, have you heard it yet, or you'll hear it later? So now I just fill you in a little bit. Yes, it's a minig Yisrael, particularly among Litvakim, not to sell chametz gamur. But I don't want to be a wise guy, and I made clear to you that we all are samach, whether we live in Borough Park and Yerushalayim, we're all samach on chametz gomer being sold, because Pashkes, how many different cookies do they have? They manufacture a ton at a time. It's in storage. That's America. Here, I need not tell you, with Tanuva, the big bakeries, the bakeries that bake cookies, it's all stored, and after Pesach, the macaroni, the spaghetti, what we all buy from Rami Levi or Sherrod. So someone asked me about, he had boxes of cereal, let's say Cheerios, and unopened, he sold it. All right, if you would have asked the Rav before Pesach, he said, Besen nicht und seminiges nicht dasei. But now after Pesach, of course you can use it. You sold it. It's not chametz shavlava Pesach. Actually, this past Pesach, I don't know if you recall, but the rabbinate in Israel, paskin lahalacha, that if you minig was not to sell chametz gamur, but this Pesach they said you can be mataneder and do it. Why? People were worried with Corona about food. I mean, we all have that problem now. Everything closes down Friday. How do we go shopping, and all that goes with it. So in my case, I hope to stack up this week, and if I have a real problem, I'll ask a daughter to fill me in what I need. But they were matir lahalacha this past Pesach. I also want to mention with mikvah, I'll come back to yesterday's shiur in a second. I also want to mention with mikvah, women. So I've mentioned it in class, I believe. If not, I should mention it. Halacha l'maisa, the mikvot are all functioning. Very, I would say, min shemaim zachinu, that corona is not transmitted by water. And this, my daughter filled me in, because in my son-in-law's shul, half the medical faculty of Shaarei Tzedek davens there, including their big expert on contagious disease. He's the one who told my daughter, Purim time, your father is not allowed into the shul. I'm over 80, and he, before we realized how serious it was, he already told my daughter, anyone over 65, not allowed into the shul. That's my son-in-law's shul. So to go to mikveh is not a problem. The mikveh are kept very clean. You have to make an appointment. A woman who is in isolation is in isolation. Zain Bray Raf, not just, it's common sense. You don't want to be in close contact with anyone. So halacha l'maisa, at least the tarat mishpachar aspect of this disease, this nega, has not been a problem. Okay? Now, regarding my shiurim on the Holocaust, so I said, I boasted yesterday, forgive me for being boastful. I said, in my humble opinion, those 5 years, what I did on the Holocaust, were the best halacha shiurim I ever gave. They were very, very special. Some of it is written up, some of it I've published, some of it Dr. Farbstein took issue with me. Again, I can't repeat it now, but the boys wanted me to answer her, and I said, no, I have nachat that she thinks she defeated Rakefet. She taught my daughters, she's entitled to feel she knocked me out. In class, I answered her, I actually published in Tradition. It deals with the 1942, with giving the Judenrat giving the Gestapo the names of the sickly people, or the people over 65, etc. These are terrible questions. God have mercy. And that's the last Indian I spoke with the Rav face to face in 1983 on these type of shaylos. So Jack said that he remembers going to those shayurim, and he was very depressed week after week after week, what we were dealing with. And all I can say to Jack is, I'm working right now on, I think you know, I've mentioned it on the Reb Chaim Isaac Ruzhensky and Semple Sugihara. Believe me, am I depressed. But I have to control myself from getting into a plane and bombing Germany. And on the other hand, I've told you more than once, you can't teach hatred. There were German non-Jews who literally risked their lives to save Jews. Look at Herbie Maltz. Let him tell you the story of how he's alive. So you can't get into a plane and bomb. We just have to accept the evil and be thankful for the good. And take a look, because of Semple Sugihara, Nat Lewin estimates his mother was saved, his parents were saved by Semple, he was saved by Semple Sugihara. Nat Lewin estimates that over 100,000 Jews are alive today because of Semple Sugihara, and a very high percentage of them are religious, and a very substantial percentage live in Israel. So there's a lot to be said here for Chassid Umat Olam. And there were more like him, but I, in particular, have to be Makatova, because I'm sitting here teaching Torah B'tochecha Yerushalayim because of Sempo Sugihara. All right, so it is depressing, but then again, Tisha B'Av is depressing, and Asarah Chagei Malkot on Yom Kippur is depressing, Eila Eskara, Tisha B'Av, Yom Kippur, and this is part, unfortunately, of our geshichta, of our saga as Torah people before God and man. Now, with the Mechiret Chametz, so, you know, yes, we are Mevatel Chametz, but the Achronim were very upset with someone who was Mevatel Chametz and didn't sell it, someone who was engaged in chicanery. And you saw the Noldeb Yehuda was furious because this big casket of whiskey, which the people knew was chametz, and they didn't burn it. They knew already Erev Pesach. All right, it was Shabbos. Remember, I read the Shiva to you. It was Shabbos. They couldn't do anything. But at least first day Cholamoid, burn it, take it down to the river, get rid of it. So he wouldn't see any heta. But where people are b'shogeg, not b'mezit, like the case we're dealing with, in other cases, the Chok Yaakov, etc. So there, you can have direct hana, but if you mevatel it after Pesach, bitul d'oraita, two against one, b'dievid, most achronim were matir. All right, that's just repeating a little bit to make myself clearer, but the question hangs fire, what happened to the Shamus? Now, I want to thank Mark Licht. He sent me an email that Rav Pesachiah Fried, to whom the tshuva is written, is a very well-known Rav in Brooklyn today, gives shayurim, and people send around Mara Makomet. So it's interesting, his name is the one that Rav Menashe Klein was writing to, and he's active and well-known today, La'arichi Jamam Tovim, etc. I also want to mention with great joy, and here my daughter played a bit of a role, the State of Israel, and again, it hurts, you have all these politicians speaking, and I think we all learned the lesson, so already Chazal say that there's some people who love themselves more than money, some people love money more than themselves. I could never understand that. How could a person say, let me die, but I don't want to lose my money? And this is what Chazal say. Now we have no problem. Well-known Israeli politicians said openly, let everyone die, let the old people die, let the sick people die, but we don't want to lose our economy. So we saw a kiyum of Chazal. But Baruch Hashem, the majority went out with Seichel, although some of the Torah Jews, Litman and some others, are an absolute, in my opinion, a disgrace to anything that represents Torah. Look, it's not my concept of Torah. It's not the Torah I received, Mimori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, from Rav Chaim Brisker, and all the Dorot before them. I feel bad saying it, but Asicha Ve'akali. So, sometimes the Israeli government, with all the machloket, does something that is historic. And the government did something historic. I spoke about it a few years ago. What happened was a lot of people today are Israeli citizens, dual citizenship, and men that want to torture women play games with the fact that they can live in America and get a hetamei rabbanim and not give a get. The woman in Israel is stuck in aguna. So the Israeli government, it went before the Supreme Court, if you recall, and the Supreme Court ruled, and I got to say, it's one of the few times the Supreme Court ruled with Jewish understanding that anyone who's Jewish and comes to Israel and his wife goes to the Beit Din, they can hold him in Israel, not let him go, even though he's not an Israeli citizen, until he gives a get. And there was a big outcry, Haaretz, this is discrimination. But Baruch Hashem, this law was passed for 3 years, and because of this law, 57 women in Israel got kitten, were no longer agunot, and 25 women were freed in Europe. And Rav Pinchas Goldschmidt, my dear friend, and to a certain degree, my Talmud Chaver, says he's pleading with the government now to make the law permanent, because Jews are visiting in Israel, and if they know they're going to be stuck here and they can't get out, they will think twice about making their wife an aguna. One other interesting comment, Charlie, let's see if you remember all this. My resident, I used to call him when I taught him a number of times, one of my greatest students ever. You all drink Coca-Cola on Pesach. He gives dashgacha for the OU, goes to Ireland, etc. Rabbi Norman Schloss, I used to call him my resident Yeki in the class, which he was originally in BMT. So he, remember we were talking about Washington Heights, Gruenspech's butcher shop was on 168th and Broadway. The one you were thinking about, that's the one I was talking about, was Abels and Hyman, which was on Audubon between 181st and 182nd. They had the best of schnitz, if I'm pronouncing it right. Is that salami? Charlie, is that a sort of a salami? Yeah, Charlie shaked me his head, it's a salami. And the lady I met was Abel's daughter, I believe. And she was telling me when Rabbi Riskin found out she was Abel's daughter, he started dancing at Kazatska. Your father's salami was the greatest I ever tasted. The bakery was Tasty Pastry on 168th and Broadway. So we now have all the information. Finally, I want to show you what intellectual dishonesty is. Azafadubnkite, a disgrace, and yet it's engaged in. This is the latest issue of Hamodia in English, right? Their weekly, that's everyone in Israel gets, everyone in Borough Park gets. And here they have a whole article on Reb Moshe Bick. I knew Reb Moshe Bick. I spoke in learning with Reb Moshe Bick. He was one of my inspirations. And they write about Reb Moshe Bick, and this was my family, Malkus family, their poskim with the Rabbi Bick's father, Rabbi Bick's uncle. And they write about how he came to America and where he went to study. Not one word mentioned about Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Elchanan. It just says that Reb Shimon Shkop was in America and he gave Sheorim, and Reb Moshe Bick was attracted to him. And afterwards it says that to this yeshiva, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik came, the son of Reb Chaim, served as Rosh Yeshiva. Yeshiva's name is never mentioned. And subsequently here, Rosh Bick enjoyed a very warm relationship, each of them holding the other in the highest esteem. In fact, Reb Moshe was routinely introduced to visiting Talmidei Chachamim and dignitaries as a poster child of sorts, to be forgotten learning. Look what America has produced. Not one word about Yeshiva University. Anyone in the world who ever picked up Aaron Rakefid's book, there are four different editions, Bernard Revel, Bull of American Jewish Orthodoxy, he's going to learn right away. Where did Rav Shimon Shkop teach? Yeshiva University. Rothkopf published the picture of Reb Shimon Shkop sitting in front of the yeshiva in 1929. All right, there was no computer then. You can't play games with a picture. This was a real picture. Who writes about Reb Moshe Soloveitchik coming to again America? Anyone who picks up the Revel book, anyone who picks up the Rav, the world of Reb Joseph Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, he'll learn right away. What are you hiding from the world? Be moida la'emet. Be makatoiva for what you have to be makatoiva. You want to be critical? All right, there are other problems today you can be critical about. But masha haya, haya. Okay, let me come back here now, Asicha ve'akali, and let's run on. Tremendous changes after World War II. RCA, OU, are on the map. They have successfully integrated themselves on the American scene. But on one hand, to the left, you have the conservative movement, which is more powerful than ever. As we explained last week, this is the American Jewish religion. Multiple ethnicity and the melting pot bound into one, blended into one, synthesized. You can't do better. Then you have the right wing that has arrived. And this is a different world already. These are Hasidim and Litvakin who ran to America to save their lives. They did not come to America to throw the shaitel overboard when they passed the Statue of Liberty, to throw the tefillin overboard when they passed the Statue of Liberty, to throw the kippah overboard when they passed the Statue of Liberty, and among them Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael. So here you have the conservative ketubah, which we spoke about, RCA trying to get support from Agudas HaRabbanim. Agudas HaRabbanim refused, even on this issue, to join with RCA and publicly denounce the conservative ketubah. And Reb Simcha Elberg said it all. Here's a survivor, Warsaw through Shanghai, comes to America 47, Lamdan Muvhak, Agudas HaRabbanim, HaPardes, and he says, RCA, 40% of their membership have mixed pews. RCA, 40% of their membership speak on a microphone on Shabbos. I don't know if 40% is correct, but how can we join with them? Eisfarts, Shkatzim, Amerikanische Rabbanim, compromises right down the line. What is fascinating is by this time there's more than the Agudas HaRabbanim, because they wouldn't accept the American trained rabbis, and they looked upon the American trained rabbis certainly from Yeshivas Chochanan, but most of Teira Vidas and Chaim Berlin, these Ein Rabbanim Amei Haaretz, Vifel Kenin Zei, these are rabbis, they're ignoramuses, how much do they know? And they just pushed them away. Water seeks its own level. A vacuum will not stay that way forever. And they formed Igor HaRabbanim, the Rabbinical Alliance. And they already spoke with RCA. Teddy Adams was president of RCA, Upper West Side, Orach Chaim. Ralph Pelkowitz, rabbi of the White Shul, Torah Vadas graduate. What was the difference between them? If you knew Teddy Adams, all right, Talmud of the Rav. If you knew Rav Pelkowitz, Talmud of Rav Shraga Feigl Mendelovich, there was basically no difference between them. And they had a very warm relationship. And they met once and twice and thrice, and presented a whole plan for full amalgamation between RCA and Rabbinical Alliance. They joined forces together, came out against the conservative Ptuva, held a joint press conference, but when it came to amalgamation, the Young Turks were not Rabbi Adam, were not Rabbi Pelkowitz. They already were influenced by what happened after World War II. And watch, they said, and this is all you'll find in Louis Bernstein's book, I'm quoting from page 134, he has everything documented, and they said, we're willing to consider merging with RCA, but the Halachic Commission has to be expanded, okay? Now, what was the Halachic Commission of RCA? Originally, Rabbi Simcha Levi. However, as time moved on, the Rav came in. All right, who else sat with the Rav? I welcome you with open arms, but I don't want to take names till after Sukkot, because then we'll know more formally if we're alive. Let's mekavel tov. I'm sitting here behind a see-through wall, and a new student just walked in, and the Rebbe is looking for new students. He'll actually pay them with some of his books if they become good Talmidim. So who sat with the Rav? You tell me. I have students in front of me, very elegant, important, world-famous people sitting here. Who sat with the Rav? Rav Shmuel Belkin. Rav Chaim Heller. Now, what does that mean? Each one had a PhD. The Rav, when the Rav opened his mouth, he turned to Rav Chaim Heller. Rav Chaim Heller shook his head, yes. Perfect. Rav Shmuel Belkin's role was to pacify the Rav. Joey Abelow can tell you the Rav had a bad temper. The Rav himself, we have the Rav on the recording. I told you many times in Moriah where the Rav says, yeah, Reis, and he's talking about Chodesh Elul. He says, I'm trying to control my temper. I know I get angry at times, but he says, I have some success, but not too much, and the audience is hysterical. So Shmuel Belkin's job was to calm the Rav down. But there's no question, the RCA Halachic Commission was Mori Urevi HaRav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, Zeicher Tzadik Livracha. Rav Chaim Heller was triple icing on the cake. Reb Shmuel Belkin was the chocolate part of the cake. Quiet him down, keep him calm. And I can tell you this, when you went in for the oral bechinot, which one by one, everyone I know, I'm from the dividing line. My class, I believe, was the first class written bechinot. It may have been the second class. It could be the year before us also. But the oral bechinot, you went in with your chavruta. So there were people, Reb Shmuel Belkin would say, if the Rav gets nervous, Zogonish, don't say anything. Leave it to me. I knew one Musbach of the yeshiva. He died the last year, well into his 90s. He carried a picture of Reb Shmuel Belkin in his wallet. So I said to him, all right, Reb Shmuel Belkin took you into the yeshiva. You were an orphan, but Ad Kedei Kach, you never heard a shir from him. He said, if not for Reb Shmuel Belkin, I would have not gotten smicha. Reb Shmuel, when he went in, Reb Shmuel says to him, Shloimela, mach nicht da tumul. Don't make too much noise. If the Rav starts shouting, leave it to me. Du schweig, you be quiet. But this was RCA, Mori Rebbe, Rav Yosef Tov, Alev Yisoloveitchik. Oh, Professor Green, now let me tell you who the young Turks from Rabbinical Alliance wanted on the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. And here's the list. Reb Elie Meir Bloch of Telz, Cleveland. Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, high in Berlin. Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Moshe, Tiferet Jerusalem. Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, Teira Vidas. Reb Yaakov Yitzchak Ruderman, Ne Yisrael, Reb Aaron Cutler, Lakewood. No, I want to ask you, do you start to understand what's happening? All right, I don't want to say these were all right-wingers. I believe Rav Ruderman had a college degree, although it's probably hidden in the history that's written today. But I need not tell you, you're talking about Gedolei Yisrael, who had a very different basic hashkafa than the Rav. And if they want all these people on the halachic commission, all right, Rabbi Soloveitchik is one vote, Rabbi Belkin is one vote, Reb Chaim Heller is one vote, but then take a look who you have, you're outvoted automatically. You're going to start up with Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Elie Bloch, who are we talking about? And this attempt to merge the RCA and the Rabbinical Alliance never got off the floor. The elder Rabbanim, the older rabbis, would have worked it out. They had no big problem. Rabbi Pelkowitz and Rabbi Adams saw eye to eye on 99% of the questions that would come up. But the younger element, post-World War II, wanted no part of it. Gedolei Yisrael, they're the ones who decide. Das Teira, Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. Those of you that went to the computer this morning, it's a busy morning, I know, but I wake up at, I don't even want to tell you, but Shlichus, I always say these are sleep-deprived times, and after Shlichus Shachris, and Kriyas HaTeirahind, and then to Grus, and answering emails, etc. But I had time to look at some of the websites, look at Yeshiva World News. Endless new appointments to the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah in New York. And it even affects the very building I'm talking to you from. Very simply, there's an institution here, Torah Shraga. One of the Menahalim is my dear student, Michael Olson. Michael Olson's first cousin, Reb Yeruchim, Rosh Yeshiva Lakewood, was just one of the new appointees to the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah in the United States. So you can see where RCA and Igud HaRabbanim went their separate ways. Now, just a contemporary word, because I have friends in both organizations, and I can be honest with you, I was actually invited to speak at the Rabbinical Alliance recently. I told them, when I'm in America, you're not in session. Normally I'd be in America part of the summer. But I have friends, I have Talmidim, the head of RCA is my dear Talmud, Rabbi Mark Tratch, Rabbi Gil Student, my dear Talmud Chaver is active in Rabbinical Alliance. Today, there are still differences between them. Rabbinical Alliance is more strident on the issue we're going to come to later this term, Synagogue Council and the fallout, mixed board of rabbis. They're more right-wing in Israel. They're much more in the camp I belong to, right of center politically. RCA is, on both issues, they have a lot of right, but they have a lot of center and some left as well. So there are marked differences between them on that level. They're both very large organizations today. Both RCA and Rabbinical Alliance also claims they're over 1,000 members. RCA, of course, is much better known as a result of their work with OU. Technically speaking, it's the RCA that's responsible for the kashrut standards in the OU. Halacha lemaisa, it has been, I would say, moved sideways, because in RCA today, in the OU today, you have Rabbi Menachem Gnack, you have Rabbi Elephant, you have an entire organization which was engendered by the RCA, but it has morphed into Gedolei Yisrael, who are absolute experts in Kashrut. And I need not tell you, Rabbi Heschel Shechta, I can also reveal, which I think is a bit of a secret, I don't like secrets in this nature, with the death of Rabbi Belsky, who worked together with Rabbi Shechta, I am told that Rabbi Asher Weiss, too, is called upon when there's a difficult halachic question. They will have input from both Rabbi Heschel and from Rabbi Asher. And I think you're dealing with two giants of the generation. And of course, I privileged Rabbi Heschel and I go back to childhood together. Rabbi Weiss, I know from Israel. I know basically from Gris, Torah Shraga, and I have Talmidim, people looking at me on the screen, who go to his Sheyurim here in Israel. Now, while all this was happening, and time marches on, a lot of problems that seem major in the course of time dissolve themselves, for better or for worse. But right at this moment in the mid-50s, a tremendous problem came on the American scene, Yesh Me'ayin. And this problem became a definitive moment in the history of Torah in the United States. In retrospect, it set the course for so-called modern orthodoxy, YU orthodoxy, or what Rakefet calls Torah in the Western world way of life. It guides us until today. In addition, it put Mori Rebbe into the front line, the limelight, and he remained there until today, will remain there as long as Jews walk the face of the earth. Now, let's say a few words about Rabbi Soloveitchik. I've said this before, but I want to say it again in context, otherwise you can't appreciate what is about to happen. When I was doing my work on Rabbi Revel, my research, so first I worked with the archives, and then I went to visit the people who were still alive, who knew Rabbi Revel, worked with Rabbi Revel, but I wanted to do the archival work first. Why, Vic, why did I want to do the archival work first? Because I knew people see things through their own prism. I try to be totally intellectually honest. Am I? Halavai, 95%. Because you have your own prism, your own way of thinking. But archives don't lie. So first get what you think is a more true picture, then fill it in with interviews. One of the people I went to interview was the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, Professor Finkelstein. Professor Finkelstein was ashamed of her. His father was a Rav in Brooklyn, a Yudapayish Rav, and Louis Finkelstein was personally frum, but caught up in the seminary, did a lot of research on Jewish self-government, Middle Ages, published on Rabbi Akiva as well, was a fine scholar. And he's chancellor of the seminary, and I'm a young rabbi from Maplewood, New Jersey. I make an appointment to see him, and I walk in. His girl Friday greets me. Little did I dream that his girl Friday, her daughter, would become my student, marry a student of mine, etc. And I go in to see Louis Finkelstein, and I start badgering him with questions, which may be among my most important Polish scholarship today. The attempt to merge the yeshiva and the seminary in the late 20s. And Rabbi Finkelstein gave me a lesson, taught me a lesson that I never forgot. I thank him for it until today. He said to me, Rabbi Rothkopf, you're a young man today. I've achieved in life. I'm the chancellor. I was once a young man like you. Do you think in the 1920s I was privy to all the secrets and all the negotiations and all that was going on? I was in short pants. He said, I'm going to read your book and learn from it because you're doing the research. And I never forgot that. He hit the nail on the head. And I have a lot of divrei Torah to say on this, but leave it at this for now. So, I have to tell you about the Rav. The Rav was a genius. His father favored him. You read Shulamit Meiselman's memoir, you know what I'm talking about, his sister's memoir. He was the apple of his father's eyes. The Kovner Rav wrote about him. He has the feeling, the gestalt, of Rav Chaim Brisker. That's what the Kovner Rav wrote about him. And he gets smicha, he wound up in Berlin. He tried desperately, again, I can't go, I've spoken about this in the past, he tried desperately to become, and he never revealed the city, but Aaron Akefit will guess aloud, because I'm 98% sure I'm right. When his uncle died, the Magid Meshurim of Vilna, Rav Menachem Karakovsky, the Avedis HaMelech, he wanted to become a Dayan, the Magid Meshurim of Vilna, under Reb Chaim Meisel. And he was not elected. And he decided to go to America, as the Rav said once when he spoke about the efficacy of prayer. Had God answered my prayers, I wouldn't be alive today, my wife wouldn't be alive today, my children wouldn't be alive. I'm quoting the Rav word by word. So he decided, all right, he has a doctorate. People with a doctorate in Lutvische Welt, they looked at you askance, came to America. No, he came to America, greenhorn, got his ears beaten up. You know, all know the story with the Birchat Kohanim, where his first year in America, it was Shabbos, Yontif fell on Shabbos, and Mintanish Duchenin, not allowed to Duchen. And the Rav got hysterical. Of course you have to duchen. If you duchen on Yontif, alachet kama v'kama when it's Yontif in Shabbos. And he forced them to duchen. And you all know after Shabbos they held a meeting in this shul in Boston and said the Rav is a mechal of Shabbos and he can never enter this shul again. Pardon me for speaking mamaloshen, but I received the Torah. I had to break my teeth to learn Yiddish. And I expressed myself better in Yiddish than in English at times. Et nish gelekt hanik. Do you understand that? In the 1930s into the 40s, the Rav, it's for Rosh Hashanah, the Rav didn't eat honey in Boston. Early 40s, you all know from Rakefet's research, published, etc. And I thank again Joe Abelov, helped me with my research, went into the court system in Boston, got me information. He's listening. He's from a very famous Boston family that brought the Rav and kept the Rav there. And the Rav was accused of kashrut scandals, of pocketing money, of not reporting it to the government, what the man suffered. And I told you, I know this from the family. I don't want to go further. You've heard me speak about it more than once. And then his father dies while this is happening. And tremendous machloket, whether or not he's allowed to teach at YU, the hotshot students. He's Agudas HaRabbanim, he's from the Elter Rabbanim, the fakers, the phonies, the kashrut scandal people. And again, the rubber's being investigated. He was found innocent. It's only 3 years later, 2 years later, that the rubber, that the judge, A.K. Cohn, Avraham K. Cohn, a retired judge, a reformed Jew, said about the Rav that everything he did was L'Shem Shemayim. He never took a penny. Tova told me that every year before Rosh Hashanah, he'd come to the Rav's house to drink a L'Chaim with him. All right, so the Rav is found innocent. But again, to use English that the Rav taught me, willy-nilly, teaching at YU, the Rav becomes the Rav. And I don't want to offend anyone from Boston. There are a few people sitting in front of me from Boston. With all due respects, Boston is not New York. Jay, I see what your Boston Red Sox hat on. Still not New York. All right, in Boston you had a few nice balabatim. The Abelov family. Joey's father was a big Talmud Chacham, a Slabatka graduate. He had a few balabatim, knew how to learn. But what did the Rav have there? Maimonides' kids. Comes to New York, he starts teaching a shiur, YU, Reitz, the finest minds seeking Torah were going to Reitz. Even Hamodia couldn't deny that Rav Shimon Shkab taught there and Rav Meisher Soloveitchik, and now the Rav. From that classroom, the Rav became the Rav. World famous, the Yad Zayin Shiur, the Tshuva Drasha, RCA, all a result of the Talmidim sitting in front of him. It began in May 1941. He gave his first shiur in YU. I say it's Niknot B'Mesira, Sidyum Baba Batra. How do you transfer a contract, a shtab? It's the first shiur. By the 50s already, it's the Rav. Moria, Tuesday night. And his self-confidence develops. And while he receded, escaped, hid from the public thoroughfare, in the mid-50s, he comes back and changes, Baruch Hashem, the course of Torah history in the world which all of us belong to. Now, what was the issue? The conservative movement is conquering synagogue after synagogue. From my own research, I have some of this published, just excuse me a second. You got to remember the feminist issue was as real then as it is today, unfortunately. We never dreamt that lesbianism and homosexuality would gain total acceptance. Rav Dach gave me Musa for saying Gentiles drink a little. Well, that's historic fact. Everything I said yesterday is based upon my courses in Bernard Revel and books that have been published. But whoever dreamt the day would come when you can arrest Rakefet for saying homosexuality and lesbianism is not normative, quote, end quote. Toeva. But the feminist issue is very powerful. 100 years ago, 50 years ago. And shul after shul, graduates of JTS would come in. And there would be the Elder Rav died, the Elder Rav retired. Now they're looking for a new rabbi. It's a new generation. The kids want an English speaker, even if they understand Yiddish and even if they speak Yiddish. But they want an English speaker. Yiddish is their second language, not their first language. My parents both spoke Yiddish, but it was their second language. They were born in Harlem. They had to know Yiddish because their parents basically spoke Yiddish at home, my grandparents. So they would say, if you elect me rabbi, you will have a rabbi who's observant. We are Shomer Shabbos. We're Makpid on Kashrut. But there's no need for a mechitza. Women today go to university, go to college, smoke in public. I need not tell you Virginia Slims, etc. Why do we have to put women behind a wall? And suddenly Yiddishkeit is put up to a vote. And when you put something up to a vote to a masses, the results are not too good. I'll give you a simple example. You all are a Shomer Torah mitzvah. You all have family Shomer Torah mitzvah. In our greater world, you put it up to a vote. Can you use legumes on Pesach? 80% will say yes. 20% will say no. In our world, the Haredi world, it would be a different shift of percentage. But in our world, and inevitably, by the way, as we intermarry, I have great-grandchildren who look totally Moroccan. I was joking around. They came to visit us the other day. These great-grandchildren are three-quarters Ashkenazi. But the one-quarter, plus my wife's family, not my wife, but her sister, could pass for a Moroccan at Taimaniya. And it shows up in great-grandchildren. So ultimately, wow, we intermingle, we intermarriage. And this is the miracle of Kibbutz Galyat of Israel. But what can I do? I have to accept the Ashkenazic Gezerah, Kitniyat. But could be 100 years from now, the Rabbanim might see otherwise. Okay, some Rabbanim already see otherwise. I need not tell you. It takes time. It takes time. But these conservative rabbis, shul after shul, put it to a vote. Look what happened at this very period. Three great conservative rabbis who we spoke about, all three products of Torah Orthodox Yeshivat. One of them, his father was the founder of Tiferet Yerushalayim, Reb Moshe's predecessor. The others were all yeshiva products. And they wrote a responsum permitting driving to shul on Shabbat. So you see, if you can permit driving to shul on Shabbat, what's so bad about taking down a mechitza? Okay. Mechitzas falls all over the place. Temple after temple established on the remains of what were Orthodox shuls. But two communities went to court. One in Michigan and one in Louisiana. Mount Clemens and New Orleans. Mount Clemens, a suburb of Detroit. If I'm wrong, you can correct me. I don't think it's part of Detroit. I think it's a suburb. And New Orleans, Louisiana. In these two instances, something was different. What was different? In each shul, there was one member who was furious and willing to fight. Mount Clemens, it's the famous, the great, I would say, someone I met a number of times, Reb Baruch Litwin, L-I-T-W-I-N. In New Orleans, it was the Katz family. And these people went to court, secular court, and they made the claim that these shuls were built, and it was particularly spelled out in New Orleans, they have to be strictly Orthodox, follow the Orthodox ritual, and if there's no mechitza, it is no longer Orthodox. And these people are being disenfranchised. Not only that, over the generations, people gave millions of dollars to the shuls to keep them going, to support them, to cover the budget. And now, if you turn it into a non-Orthodox setting, you literally have misused their money. They gave the money for Torah, for Orthodoxy, for an Orthodox ritual, and today you're spitting in their face and taking down the mechitza and disenfranchising any Jew who really wants to daven according to halacha. And more than that, if there's no mechitza, they can't enter the shul, they can't daven. Their form of worship cannot take place. They are being denied. Now, these issues have come up before, but never did it come up with, I would say, the entire Torah world watching. For the first time, a person like Baruch Litwin went to war, devoted all his energies, his money, he was a businessman, brought in the RCA, brought in the OU, and Torah felt strong enough now to go to battle, not just locally. It's not just like what happened in Cleveland in the 20s. We spoke about it last term. No. Now they're going to war nationally. All the Rabbanim in America, they even brought in Rabbanim from Israel, Rabbanim from Europe. And they brought the Ravin Bechvodo Uvi Atzmo, and with his magic command of English, his magic pen. And battles in court, we'll go into a little detail, but just to introduce it, in Mount Clemens, in a lower court, they lost. The judge ruled very simply separation of church and state. Why should a Goyish judge get involved with trying to figure out what is Orthodox, what is conservative? What is a mechitza? Do you need it? Don't you need it? On appeal to the more Supreme Court, Baruch Litwin won totally. Again, a non-Jewish judge did his research, heard the testimony, and ruled the shul has to be Orthodox. It was chartered Orthodox. It raised so much money over the years for an Orthodox shul. People cannot be disenfranchised. And the judge ruled in his favor. New Orleans, even the lower court already, ruled the charter calls for Orthodoxy, Polish ritual must remain. You can't take down the mechitza and ruin it for the Jews who care. Now, I have to tell you in all honesty, historically these were tremendous victories, as Maya Grace's name says, Grace victories. Big, important. On the other hand, to use English that I think the Rav taught me as well, they were very Pyrrhic victories. What do I mean Pyrrhic? I think you can correct me. I think there was a Roman general run a big battle, but so many of his soldiers were killed, there was nothing to boast about. It was a very Pyrrhic victory. Nachum Lam, am I right? There was a Roman general, or you're going to correct me after Shia. I'd be happy to be corrected if I'm wrong.
It was against Drum.
It was what?
Against Drum.
Against Drum. And where was the general from?
Karta Chadita.
Karta Chadita.
Also known as Karta
Kartala. Okay. As usual, my dear student Yomo knows everything. Almost everything. I'll put it that way, Yomo. Okay, so it was against Rome, but it was a Pyrrhic victory. What do I mean it was a Pyrrhic victory? Because in every case what happened was, and you actually find it in the sources, the people who lost left in the face of the few Orthodox Jews, go fly a kite, keep the synagogue. They look for a plot of land a block, a few blocks away, or in a newer area, raised $100,000, $200,000, $500,000, built a temple. Their ritual, conservative rabbi, at that point, they didn't count women for minyan, women wouldn't give an aliyat. Believe me, whatever survives of these temples today, the people who broke away from the Orthodox Jews in the 1950s would not recognize what's going on in the temple today. So we won victories, but they were very Pyrrhic on that level. On the intellectual level, they established once and for all, you want to be an Orthodox Jew? You must have a machitza. Without a machitza, you cannot daven. You do not fulfill your obligation. Without a machitza, it's not a synagogue where you can have a minyan and say Dava Sheba Kedusha. This was established. Give all the credit to Baruch Litwin, the man devoted his entire being to the battle. Brought in Synagogue Council, brought in RCA, later published a very famous volume that was given to me, a gift by him, my whole smicha class. I have an inscribed volume, The Sanctity of the Synagogue. And everyone knows that volume. The machitza was so embedded and ingrained that today, Olenu, when you have the feminist revolution and you take a so-called synagogue like Shira Chadasha, it is amazing. They still have a machitza. Women will daven famamid, l'chun aranana, sukei de zimra, right or wrong. Mariv, they now claim they can daven. It's not a chiyuv, just reshut. Women can daven for the Ahmed. Women can be balkores. Women can have aliyot, what goes on, and they call themselves Orthodox. But they have a machitza. You take some of the results, the issue in New York, and their innovative minyan. You take Chovevei Torah and some of their rabbis and their innovative minyanim. And Rabbi Weiss in his own shul, one Friday night a woman led the service. I understand there was a bit of rebellion. You can correct me. I don't think he was able to do it again. But a machitza, you must have. It goes back to the Rav, to sanctity of the synagogue, to Baruch Litwin. And Dr. Tova Lichtenstein wrote an article in Tradition years ago about her father. It's on one of the yard sites. It may have been the 25th yard site or the 20th. Baruch Atah Adonai Melech Olam Shehakol Nehyeh Bedvaro. Wrote an article, and she made the point that the what we call the modern Orthodox shul that we know today, we have to thank her father. He was the one. Without a machitza, you cannot call yourself Orthodox. Now, this battle was not so simple. And let me explain why. One of these shuls You're fighting a tremendous battle. Don't let them take away the mechitza. And the rabbi of the shul, RCA graduate, REITS graduate, member of Rabbinical Council of America, doesn't say a word. He's worried about losing his job. Got it? You're fighting a battle. And imagine the conservatives bringing their experts to testify in court. And they say, what are you talking about? 40%, 30% of the membership of Rabbinical Council of America have synagogues with mixed pews. This makes it a lot harder. Imagine you're a non-Jewish judge sitting there and you got to sort all this out. The rabbi himself doesn't take a stand. Do you need a mechitza? Don't you need a mechitza? How can you have so many RCA rabbis, shuls, without mechitzat? And I told you, when I got smicha, the only question they asked me, and this was 61 later, will you take a shul without a mechitza? That's what they wanted to know. They're willing to place you. They don't have enough shuls with mechitzat. Will you take a shul without a mechitza? And I had plenty of classmates who wound up in synagogues without mechitza. I have to say, some of them succeeded over the years in putting in a mechitza, in putting in separate seating. But I had plenty of classmates. And this made it infinitely, infinitely harder. But there's another side to the coin. It's not so simple. I've told you more than once, open up the Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch, you will not find one sif about building a mechitza in a shul. Not one sif. Look at the Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch. All right? The answer is very simple. We're going to talk about it in our first Sunday class after Sukkot. The answer is very simple. The heart of Judaism depends upon practice. Kizera Eva Kadesh, Torah Mesorah, Torah Shebal Peh. Eli and your pop, there wasn't a shul without a mechitza. From time immemorial, open up your chumetz, Al-Shashia Moshe, Vateitzeh Miriam Vanoshim Betupim U'mecholot. We've davened separately from the dawn of Jewish civilization. So you didn't need a siman in the Shulchan Aruch. But because there's no siman, what is the story with the mechitza? Ah, now let me scrub the surface. Let's go back to the Bronx. Get into a time machine. Esther, I don't know if it was ever your neighborhood, but it certainly was my neighborhood and Malka's neighborhood. The Grand Concourse. On the Grand Concourse, must be about 184th, 185th Street again. Anyone can correct me with more exact information. There was a very big, important synagogue. Concourse Center of Israel, if I have the name right. Rabbi Berman, whose brother had been killed in 29 in Hebron. He was one of the Kedoshim, a YU graduate, a YU Mismach, who had gone to Hebron to learn like you came to Israel to learn. He went to learn with Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Alt of Slabotka, and he was killed. Okay, I write about him in Revel, by the way. His brother was rabbi. Powerful speaker, I see him before my eyes. Orthodox 100%. The shul, beautiful. Rabbi Drobe had been there before. Rabbi Max Drobe, D-R-O-B. Check your conservative Torah history, conservative movement, I should say. You'll read about him. And a very powerful, famous, influential rabbi. And I can tell you from Yeshiva College faculty, Professor Brody davened there with his seed, and they never married. He and his sister never married, lived together in that neighborhood. They davened in Concourse Center. And men and women sat separately. No mechitza whatsoever. An aisle down the middle. Tell me, does that count? Is that good? Would that be sufficient? Mark, do your homework. Look up the Gemara in Sukkah, the Sugya, and Aleph, and Bet about Simchat Beit HaShoeva. Well, we have a lot of Marks listening. I'm talking to the Mark who didn't have to stay up all night. He's in Beit Shemesh, a Talmud of Rabbi Abba Brandspiegel. And the other Marks who stay up all night, kol hakavod to them, Brooklyn, Chicago, do your homework. What type of mechitza? What did they do in the Beit HaMikdash? All right, they saw the boys and girls, the men and women flirting. You got to stop it. Remember, we must... I don't want to be in a world where men and women don't flirt. It's an open Gemara in Sanhedrin and Yuma. Thank God for the sexual tension. Otherwise, there'd be no progress in life. Who would marry? Who would have children? Chickens stop laying eggs. You all know the Gemara. All right, but there's a time to daven, not to play games. So they didn't know what to do. They moved the men upstairs, the women downstairs, men, women, men, separate here, there. What is a mechitza? What is required? And you see, this question pulls you in so many different directions. Here we speak about separate seating, no mechitza. Tell me, he didn't exist yet. Rothkopf enters the rabbin at 62. I asked the rabbin, I'm coming in, building the first mechitza shul in suburban Essex County. It's all reformed conservative. No one would ever dream a day would come that from Essex County, Kushner, Jared, would be giving Sefer Torah to the head of the Amorite Republic today. You all saw the news. Had a Sefer Torah written. What'd you say?
The King of Bahrain.
The King of Bahrain. All right. The Yomo knows more than I do, but I just saw he gave a Torah. And written explicitly, Torah Mehuderet, written in honor of the king, and they're going to put it in the shul in Bahrain. And I don't reveal secrets, but part of my family works for the government here. I've already been informed that they're traveling to this area in November for the state of Israel. There's something going on, and part of my family has to be there. Maybe I'll go with them. It'd be interesting. Wow. Oh, you kosher food, Sefer Torah, Vos Feltman, nothing lacking. So, what a world. How big is your mechitza? Essex County, everyone's laughing at me. You'll never succeed. No one dreamt you could have an Orthodox shul a block away from Temple Israel and a block away from the big Bethel conservative temple and two blocks away from a reconstructionist temple and up the mountain, a big reformed temple, the most famous rabbis, reformed, conservative, Amayoritz, and Yerevein, oh God have mercy, what came out of them? What remains Jewish from that suburban Essex County that I encountered in 1962? So, b'dieved, the Rav said, 50 inches. You all know that psak, it's not l'chatchila, but if you have no choice, a mechitza, 10 tfachim, like a mechitza for Shabbos. All right. Later, I have to tell you, before I left Maplewood, I had a mechitza, 50 inches, and on top of it, decoration with glass, 60 or 65-inch mechitza, way up. All right? None of you would have a problem davening in my later shul, my later version. A satma, a mechazarav person would walk in. Was is da? Shake it. Roska, noisvaf, a trumpenik, a pushtak. Wow. A mechitza? Men and women can't see each other. 72 inches. Satmar and Merkas Aram agree on two issues. One, never to wear ties. And two, a mechitza has to be 72 inches. I have to tell you, it's a valid machlokes. What's the pashtus of the Gemara? Let's go back to the Gemara. Let's use the halachic mind. The pashtus of the Gemara is Tikkun Gadol. They separated the men and women, upstairs, downstairs, back, forward, tried every different way. It seems 100% in the Gemara, you don't need an actual mechitza. You need separate seating. That's what the Torah requires. That is Minhag Yisrael. That is the Takana. That's the way we first started worshiping when we left Egypt. And that's what they worked out in the Beit HaMikdash. This was the Rav's viewpoint. The Rav felt the Oraita, you just need separate seating. Once you have that, the synagogue is valid. You're allowed to daven there. The rabbis added on a takana to have a mechitza. And this is why, b'di'eved, 50 inches would be good enough. And the truth of the matter is, the most prominent, or the second most prominent Orthodox shul in the United States of America, the first most prominent one is probably KJ, Kehillat Jeshurun. Perhaps on the coast, they'll give me an argument and say Beth Jacob in Beverly Hills is second. But certainly the Jewish center is right up there. Rabbi Lamb, Rabbi Berman, two presidents of Yeshiva University. Where do they come from? Jewish center. Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, we spent so many shurim on him these last years. Jewish center. When was the last time you were in Jewish center? Did you notice, was there a mechitza or wasn't there a mechitza? 50 inches gets lost in the chairs. It's amazing that in the year 2020, the Jewish center still has the same mechitza it had when it was built. I think it's 1918. When the new building was built. But it's a mechitza, 50 inches. How did Rabbi Riskin begin in the shul that was revolutionary? Lincoln Square, how did he begin? 50 inches. This was the Rav's psak. Now, how many are familiar with Reb Meisher? Reb Meisher already got the shaila time and again. And he took, Rav Moshe took a middle position. And he didn't budge. He was criticized. He was attacked. The Satmar didn't make his life easy. But Baruch Hashem, Rav Moshe held his ground. Rav Moshe held 60 to 65 inches. He felt the mechitza was more than demarcation. According to the Rav, the mechitza was demarcation. B'di'avad. 50 inches is enough. But Reb Moshe felt it's to avoid physical contact. Physical contact, it basically has to be high enough that a woman is not going to lean over or a man is not going to lean back and there will be no physical contact. And Reb Moshe, lachatchila, I believe he passed in 65 inches, but the Yevet 60 inches. But I remember was the goal of every rabbi in my time, if you had at least my colleagues, my chaverim, if you began with 50 inches, at least get it to 60 to get it to 65. The Satmar and the Merkaz HaRav crowd absolutely forbidden to see a woman at a time of prayer. It's not just demarcation, not just physical contact, but total separation, zelichud v'zelichud, men women never shelved to catch each other's eye during Dvar Hashem, davening, standing before the Almighty, Dal lefnei mi ata omeid. And they held 72 inches. But halacha lemaisa, I have to tell you, this is a fallout of what happened in Mount Clemens and New Orleans. At that moment in time, the fight was for mechitza. The Rav, one of these shuls, had separate seating, but not a clearly demarked balcony for the women. And the Rav made clear that this would be sufficient at least to daven in. But afterwards, you have the whole discussion. Mechitza, this is what people are talking about. This is what the Rav is speaking about. This is what they're writing tshuvot about. And you have the entire question. How big? What is required? And this machloket, or these varial opinions, live on until today. And I need not tell you, there have been many innovations. Some have succeeded, some haven't succeeded. I still remember in Young Israel of Winfield, when they broke away from Lower Merion Synagogue right before I arrived in 61. I write about it in Washington. So one of the machlokot was, the mechitza is not big enough in Lower Merion. It was a small mechitza, I don't know, 50 inches, maybe a little more. And in Young Israel, they came up with one-way glass. But one-way glass, I have to tell you, you can never be certain it's going to work. The only time one-way glass, you can rely upon it, is when it's built lachatchila, the lighting, the glass, the angle. When you superimpose many years later, it will not necessarily be successful. I remember I used to hear rumors that in Winfield, part of Shabbat it worked, part of Shabbat when you looked at it, you just saw yourself, part of Shabbat if you looked at it, you saw the women. It remained a question. But remember, one-way glass, even if you see the women, and as I recall, I had glass as part of the higher part of my mechitza, you could see the women. So what? If you hold that men and women are allowed to see each other, the pashtus of the Gemara in Sukkah, so then, doesn't matter. The glass is a mechitza, the glass is higher, the glass avoids contact. It is an achievement, even if men and women can see each other. So you see, this all remains a very open issue. How high a mechitza? How big a mechitza? This problem translates, I need not tell you, in Europe, every shul had a balcony. You have an entire history in America, beginning with KJ and Max Setra. We've often spoken about it. Do you need a balcony? Take the balcony down. The women want to be next to the men. The women want to be part of it. The women want to feel part of the service. Are you lowering the kedusha of the shul by taking the balcony down? I have to tell you, there's some shuls today where they will not take the balcony down. Spanish Portuguese synagogue, everything is tradition. This is the way the shul was built. This is the way they davened in Portugal. This is the way they davened in Spain. We will not change the structure. Kehilat Jeshurun had a fire. They rebuilt the shul. Malka was just watching. She went to Ramaz, Kehilat Jeshurun. It's a bitter part of her life. Not that she davened there, but Ramaz was based in one of their main school structures was in Kehilat Jeshurun, in the shul, in KJ. How many times have I davened in KJ? And we looked at the new shul. We think the balcony for the women is even higher than it was before the fire burned it down. I think they put in a Shabbos elevator, but they kept the balcony. And you see the shoot-off from this whole question. You can do volume after volume of collecting shalot and tshuvot, one after another. What about if the women expand? Women didn't go to shul. The Baal Shem Tov shul, the shtibel in Meshbetz, that brings in a fortune of money for the... Is it in the Ukraine? Am I right, Yomo? Brings in a fortune of money in the Ukraine? No place for women. Malka's family came from Meshbetz. Women never went to shul. Not Rosh Hashanah, not Yom Kippur, not all year. Whoever heard of women going to shul? Now, women start going to shul. You build an Ezrat Nashim, and more women are coming, more women are educated, more women want to daven, more women can afford to buy ready-made food. Remember, when I came in Aliyah to Israel, whoever dreamt that you would have place after place, location after location, selling ready-made food for Shabbos. I'm talking now before Corona. When you went to Hadam Mall on Friday, the whole mall was filled with food for Shabbos. You go to Geula, you go to Romema. Oh, what's doing? Women, their whole Sudah made to order, and they have time to go to shul. They want to go to shul. Now, tell me, can you make the women's section longer, larger, taking advantage of the men's section, cutting it down? Are you allowed to do this? Men are obligated. Men have to daven. Men have a chiyuv. Men kedusha minyan, kedusha bekedusha. And now you're taking part of the men's section and you're turning it into a woman's section. A chelek favaiba, an eintret favaiba, a place for the women. Very interesting. You can come up with shaila after shaila with the kedushat beknesset, with the separation, with the mechitza. What do you have? What can you build? How do you build? How do you structure? And we in the year 2021, we have to deal with the problem. A woman wants to feel at home, not left out, not pushed all the way to the back. She wants to feel part of the service. I'm quoting what women have told me. How do we accommodate them? And finally, let me just add that one of the most moving tshuvot is in Reb Moshe Feinstein, is the Russian story. And the Russian story hasn't been told properly. It's time to really tell it, let the world know. There was a lot of Mesirat Nefesh in Russia. What the Mossad did, it's overwhelming when I look back. The millions of dollars, tens of millions of Israeli taxpayer money. And I'm allowed to talk about it now. 2002, they lifted the security clause on myself and Malcolm. And thank God, we can talk about it, we can write. I wrote about it, the Mossad put out a book, they wrote about it. But you can't even start to imagine. I can entertain you with stories that movies have to be made. But one of the questions Reb Moshe gets, I think it was from Minsk, is that the KGB, the communists, the Jewish communists took over everything. Well, Jewish life can't go on. The most essential part of Jewish life is a mikveh. What we spoke about an hour and a half ago. Without a mikveh, you can't have Jewish life. Where do they do with a mikveh? The communists. Nothing is worse than a mikveh. So, they had the shul. The shul in Minsk. At least they left it in Jewish hands. It was what the KGB used to call them, using their language, a functioning synagogue. And every city left one functioning church, one functioning synagogue. They kept an eye what's going on. But in the functioning synagogue, in the women's section, can they build a mikveh? That was the only place where they felt they could get away with it. They could build a mikveh. Generally speaking, KGB agents didn't walk into that part. And the whole question of Kedushat HaMakom. You're taking a place for davening, you're taking a place of Kedusha, you're taking a place of Kedushat Nashim, and you're building a mikveh. When all is said and done, a mikveh is a mikveh, but people walk around nude, naked. It's not something that you can put into a shul. Are you allowed? And Rav Moshe, of course, paskin that under those circumstances, if that's the only solution, then of course build the mikveh, the cover, the l'tiferet. Rav Moshe has a number of tshuvot that bring to life the Russian tragedy. There's another tshuva with kashrut. Imagine your children. It's like today, the shaila comes up, you raise kids, and the kids go off the path, but they keep a kosher home. Their parents should be able to eat there. If you're lucky, if the kids have at least some semblance of responsibility, they keep a kosher home. So can you trust them? Can you believe them? Imagine children high in the Communist Party, totally integrated. This is Reb Moshe's famous tshuva, Moscow. And the elder parents, kosher people from before the revolution, and the children claim, Tata and Mama, ba'uns can do essen, you can eat in our house, we've keep kashrut. Can you depend upon such children? Can you eat in their house? Reb Moshe deals with it. He's no telahakel if you think the children are trustworthy or honest. And these shilas come up time and again under the communists. What we have gone through. We have gone through. We don't recognize the miracle of Kibbutz Goliath of Israel, of all that's happening. And I blame part of it as our politicians. I'll end off, I'll tell you something. I've given lectures on many different topics. Unfortunately, I know too little or know too much. I can't win in life. You all know that. I can entertain you now for a long time, but when I came back from 90, if you read Washington or you come into my office, there's a picture where I'm presenting Bernard Revel to Professor Katsia and President of Israel. Charlie, you know who I'm talking about. And we did that. It was YU. We had a few YU. People wanted the world to know why you exist. It was 1972. So when I came back, Nechama Leibowitz asked me, what did you talk about? I said, well, I gave a talk that only you, Professor Ephraim Katsia, Rakata, I'll say it in Hebrew, but I hope people listening know about in Hebrew. Rakata Yechola Havin Mazlot Yeshiva Universita. Bin Yeshivat Anachnu Nechshavim Le'Universita. Ben Universitat Anachnu Nechshavim Le'Yeshiva. And the Chabalewitz says to me, you're lucky you got away alive. Because what you're saying is, I said to Professor Katsir, among scientists, you're considered the president of Israel. Among presidents, you're considered a scientist. He could interpret it. It means you know nothing. So I can't win in life. Among Rashi Yeshiva, I'm considered a rotten, vicious, malicious academic. He doesn't know a word in learning. An Amar, it's a Bur, the Oraita. Among academia, people look at me, who's Rakefet and nobody, a Rosh Yeshiva, no Shas and Paiskim, a little bit can be Mafalpil, tell you stories, doesn't know a word of scientific scholarship. So I have to tell you, when either I know too little or I know too much, but either way, it hurts when you know too much, and the story has, there's so many stories have to be told. But the gauntlet of Russian Jewry, the Baal Tshuva movement, all right, today it's becoming ancient history. Russia is Russia, Israel is Israel, the Jews are Jews, and halavai, we should succeed with Corona, and everyone should come al-aliyah, l'kavod l'tiferet. So let me reiterate. This is our last shayur before the long break and before the lachen. I just want people around the world to know I'm totally cut off from Grus, totally cut off from the world. I just am in my own little Dalet Amot for the 3 weeks beginning on Erev Rosh Hashanah. What did we do today? All right, we set the ground. There's no question that following World War II, The world is shaking. The world is changing. We'll see it in the Sunday class next time we meet. It merges with the Monday class, actually. It merges with Reb Menashe Klein. It's very fascinating. But RCA, Agudat HaRabbanim, wouldn't look at them. Ad kidei kach, that even to fight the conservative ketuvah wouldn't hold a joint meeting with the RCA in public. All right? This tells you something. Rabbi Elberg plays a big role. He's an interesting individual. I'm writing about him now. Then Igor HaRabbanim, much warmer to RCA, joins with RCA against the conservative ketuvah, but their requirements for joining and amalgamating and merging the organizations, the Young Turks are basically saying, we are taking over. Halachic Commission, it's no longer a one-man show, Rav Soloveitchik. Right? He has to remain, of course, that there are cherets from everyone else who he is. But Rav Moshe, Rav Aaron Kotler, Rav Elia Bloch, Rav Rudiman, Rav Hutner, etc., Rav Kamenetsky, they have to join with the Rav. Well, I need not tell you. RCA people couldn't handle it. This is all a fallout of synagogue council. We're going to talk about it. And the merger never got off the floor. Today, they are two very large organizations. I believe RCA is known throughout the world, but mainly it's not just RCA. The RCA based in Rav Heschel Schechter, Rav Morty Willig, Rav Mark Dratch, but it's the interconnection with the OU. Igudei HaRabbanim, as Rabbinical Alliance, also claims, I understand, over 1,000 members, and they tell me they're alive and kicking. They even reached out to yours truly, Aaron Rekhefet, and invited him to come address them. So it's fascinating what could have been and what is. But this jolt that comes along, and I described the Rav's life, and I believe I'm... By the way, anyone from the family who's heard me speak about this part of the Rav's life tells me I've hit the nail on the head. I once spoke in Boston in Young Israel of Brookline many, many years ago, and there were older people there who literally kissed me after my lecture, Shayur. How do you know this? We lived it. I said, look, research is research, and I did my research, and these are the conclusions I reached, and they absolutely, totally agreed with me. There wasn't even one syllable that they wanted to correct. And Mount Clemens in New Orleans, it comes out of nowhere, basically, because until now, synagogue after synagogue, shul after shul became a temple, but now, for the first time, publicly and nationally, it's not like what happened in Cleveland years earlier. Here it became national news, and you have Jewish newspapers in every big city, headlines, what a battle, and in Mount Clemens, you have to realize Litwin, Baruch Litwin, put his heart and soul into this battle, invested a fortune of money, but put Mechitza on the map, the sanctity of the synagogue. All right, we spoke a lot about Mechitza, there's a lot more I can speak, a lot more sources, but you get the figure, the position. It's an amorphous concept. You can have a machloket, do you need a Mechitza, separate seating, the Mechitza the Rabbanan, how big the Mechitza, 50, 65, Reb Moshe, or 72, the Satma, and Mekas HaRav as well. I believe in Boston, and let's see, Jay, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe in Maimonides, where the Rav Davin, there was a 72-inch Mechitza. Am I right? Jay is shaking his head affirmatively. So the Rav's position, I remember, was talking to Rav Meisha Bick. So Rav Meisha Bick told me, yeah, your Rebbe holds that way, but that's only b'di'evit, b'di'evit. So I told Rav Meisha Bick, I'm coming into an area where there's no mechitza whatsoever. So 50 inches is already an achievement. Let me get it off the floor, and then we'll see later. And Baruch Hashem, within a few years, I remember, I sort of recall the second mechitza was 50 wood, and then glass with some decoration on it going up. I believe it was already 65, if certainly 60, and it may have been 65. Let me end off with one story about Rav Aaron Kotler that I write about, and it's worth repeating. So Rav Aaron Kotler constantly had to raise funds for Lakewood. It's a sad story about his life. And Rav Aaron raising funds for Lakewood, Simchas Torah, there was a big hotel in Lakewood, Grossman, I think it was called. Grossman, I may be wrong, may be right, correct me. And a lot of from Jews went there for Simchas Torah, Sukkos, had a good clientele. So Simchas Torah, Rav Aaron made a reception for all these Jews. There was a fundraiser. And the final year of his life, 1962, he makes the reception at Rav Aaron, and one of the Balabatim, my vice president from the new shul in Lakewood, is there, Mr. Abe Radin. And Mr. Radin, I can just visualize him, comes over to Rav Aaron and says, Mehobin and I are Rav at Amolga learned in Lakewood. You have a new rabbi, he once learned in Lakewood. And then he went to YU, and Rav Aaron says, V'heister, what's his name? And Mr. Radin tells him, Heist Rotkov. And Rav Aaron thinks, ich denke him, I remember him. And then Rav Aaron asked him one question. The shul had a machitza? Does the shul have a machitza? And when Rav Aaron said yes, when Rav Radin said yes, Rav Aaron's eyes lit up. His pupils became like little Sifrei Torah. And I can never forget that conversation, because that's how Rav Aaron judged success. Didn't ask about my salary, but he asked, does the shul have a mechitza? And he understood very well Essex County at that time, what it meant to build a shul with a mechitza. I can tell you, halacha l'maisa, the shul thrives today, stands today. It's in the hands of a young Rabbi Bogomilsky, who grew up in the area. His father was in Newark, Chabatnikim, and he's a first-rate accountant, I'm told. And there's an Erev, believe it or not, if anyone would have told me there would be an Erev in Maplewood, New Jersey, I would have said you are insane. And they took over the church up the block. The church became the shul. My wife still can't believe it. We went back there a number of years ago. And the shul is like a dormitory. There's a little yeshiva there. Unbelievable. It never became a major, large institution because it's all one family housing on that part of Maplewood. But today, it's in very much demand because Maplewood is a very upkept, a well-kept, integrated community. And everyone is trying to run away from New York. So my dear students, first of all, I want to thank you very much for joining me online, and I want to thank you very much for joining me in person. It means the world to me. Secondly, looking at what's coming up, none of us yet know how we're going to daven, where we're going to daven. I just know we'll daven one way or another. I have to check with my son-in-law if he's opening his shul. If you saw today's post, the headlines are that the great synagogue is closed for Yontef. Can you imagine the great synagogue closed? But they have no choice. If my son-in-law is opening the shul, then I'm going to daven next to him in his little booth, whatever they call it. What's the word they use, Yomo, for the capsula. If not, I don't know what I'll do. Shofar. I can hear at 4:35, 5:36, Chabad is blowing on Rehov Chalap outside Ohel Rivka. So I can hear shofar on Sunday. And I want to wish everyone a k'tiva v'chatima tova l'shnat chayim osha with an aleph, osha with an ayin, for kol tov sela. Then we have to get ready for Yom Kippur. It should be an easy fast. The weather should be with us. And somehow we have to build the sukkah, get Dalit Minim. It's have to tell you, it's a real challenge this year. And it should be a tremendous chag, a tremendous Simchas Torah. And we should be zeicha to hear good news about the corona. And we should be able to go on to the next stage, lekavod ulatiferet, and pick up with our shiurim exactly where we left off, be'ezrat hanotein layav koach. Okay? Till we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danya. Morty, you want to turn it off and open me to questions?
The recording has stopped.
Okay. This recording is going on.
Okay.
Yes.
Just a quick historical footnote. I believe the busted Rebbe was among the first to introduce the one-way mirror effect for Mephisa. And for the architectural buffs among us, I'm quite certain it was inspired by the rather infamous event that occurred around the construction of the Prudential Center in the John Hancock Building in Boston, which had a sheet of that one-way glass, and it's introduced to use it as a mefitza. And from what I recall, it was quite effective, although the women used to complain that they could see the men very clearly, and often they had to endure sights that they didn't necessarily want to see.
Wow.
But it was absolutely opaque from the men's side.
Uh-huh. Very fascinating. Kol hakavod. Yasher koach. Regards home. Lishnat chayim v'shalom. Go ahead. Anyone else?
Yeah. Rabbi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Rabbi David Cohn's shul in Brooklyn does have a one-way mirror. And I think Shari Tfila has it also, where you've been each year.
Well, I'll tell you. In Shari Tfila, It's not a one-way, it's some sort of funny, opaque glass. And I'll tell you what the problem is there. They went from a modern Orthodox shul to a big shtibel. The women can't hear. If anyone speaks, the women can't hear. When I get up to speak, I've been there many years, I don't know what it'll be in the future, but it was one of the high points of the year. For me, I hope for them, so the women would come into the men's section. They had to divide the shul in two-thirds were men and one-third women, and they couldn't hear if they stayed behind the machitza. And the women actually rebelled and came in, and I can't blame them. If someone's speaking, they want to hear. They're intelligent women. Many of them were my students, and they literally broke rank and file and marched in, and then already the last few years they arranged it in advance and announced that one section the men should all move and this section is for women. Yeah, that's a follow-up one.
Illumination higher on the women's side, be able to get it to be one-way glass. By the way, Park East has men and women on the balcony.
Park East has men and women on the balcony, but divided up, I imagine.
Divided up. It's a low machitza, but they are divided up over there.
Okay.
My youngest of Winfield moved across the city line. I assume you were aware of that. It's called Yom Yisrael of the main line now.
Right. It moved into the main line because Winfield became impossible, the neighborhood, which you can't believe. At my time, Winfield was the fanciest neighborhood in Philadelphia. Rabbi Twesky can verify that. But then they moved, and the time marched on, and everyone moved to the suburbs, and they moved. How far are they from Lower Merion today?
They're a little farther, I think, than the Lower Merion shore.
Well, further out. Further out, you mean?
I think they're near the Kollel. I haven't been there in years, so
okay.
I don't remember, but I think the shuls are more or less around the same place.
Okay.
The Kollel and that.
Okay.
I think there's something else. There may be an ish there also. Spanish-Portuguese, by the way, has a temporary machitza downstairs for women who can't walk up because there's no Shabbos elevator.
Wow.
They're trying
to
build a new building. They needed permits for it. They have the permits, but they have to fundraise, so it's not going to be. They just got approval to pave the area, the construction area, for more outdoor area because they've been davening on the roof of Manhattan Day School for a while.
Wow.
Until last week.
Wow.
And they're doing the Amim No Rahim.
Wow.
As far as moving into the men's section, they say that the Rav once was asked if he meant that the mechitza has to create a separate reshut for the men and the women, and he said no.
Okay. So he wouldn't,
because he asked that, and others say also, like for a Shiva minyan, when you have two different rooms, they have to be in the same room. You have to have at least a minyan in one room. So Rav Shachter holds that if the mechitza is mechuba la karka, then the women have to move into the men's area in order to say kaddish if they want to.
Oh, hold on. Don't get us involved in that question. But as far as Shiva, there's no requirement for mechitzah. It's not a permanent place of davening. You just have to have men and women separate. It's like you're on a B'nai Akiva's on a tiyul. I'm a kid on a tiyul. So we would stop for mincha, and the men and women would be separate. And then I learned that's takada halacha. There's no such thing in a...
It's Gabe having a minion in one reshut when they die.
Right, you have to see each other.
And answer at the mitzaret, but they can't be part of the original 10. And if they want to say Kaddish, they should move into the main room.
Uh-huh. All right.
I believe it repelled that also, but when Rav Shachter said it, he said it depends, let's say, for a woman moving into the men's, it depends if the mechitz connected to the ground. If it's movable, they don't have to move, which would seem to mean because it's the same reshut. I was just in an outdoor minyan a week and a half ago, and there were people on the other side. There was this area, and there was a fence in between, and someone was saying Kaddish on the other side. So I said to the Gabbai, L'chadchila, it might be better if he moved into the main area. And apparently he said they asked the Shaila. There may have been other reasons, L'gabbai, if he had been ill or something like that.
All I can tell you is that down the block from me, they were running a minyan in back of the Forest Hills project. And people were on the fifth floor terraces saying Kaddish to a minyan going on downstairs. But there was eye contact. But we're living now in a very bidyevet situation. It's like I said yesterday about the whole silo with Zoom and answering Amen. So you told me about the shul. I'm well aware of it. The shul in Alexandria. But that's all of bidyevet. But we have to live with it. Okay.
One little thing. Mentioned about not mentioning the name of YU when they were talking about the Rebbeim or Abikler and things like that. At the Chag HaSmicha, shortly after Rav Moshe's Levaya, it was between Rav Moshe's Levaya and Rav Alpert's Levaya. Rav Alpert was there.
Right.
And mentioned that at Rav Moshe's Levaya,
there was... Norman Lamb.
So, right. Rabbi Lamb mentioned that there were three speakers who were Yeshiva in YU. One was Rav Tendler, referred to as the son-in-law. One was Rav David, referred to as the Sevalcher. And one was, who was the other? I don't remember anymore.
Rav Alpert, the Talmud Rav.
And Rav Alpert, the Talmud Rav. And all three cases, they didn't mention the name of the yeshiva, and they did with every other yeshiva. And he mentioned it at the Chagas.
All right, but this is in the year 2020, publishing such trash that any intelligent person knows it's yeshivas, it's Ohanan, and not to mention, it's beyond comprehension. I told you, if you have a criticism today of the yeshiva that lesbians are marching on Amsterdam Avenue, fine. What does that have to do with 1920, 1929? Historically speaking, yeshiva was the only game in town. And they set the ground, they turned the ground. Everything that grew afterwards was on the foundation of what Rabbi Revel went through. All right, maybe I have a particular prejudice because I'm a blood relation of Rabbi Revel. Imagine had I known that when I was a student, I might have gotten a lot of easier grades and a lot of good attention. Oh my gosh. But I would have never been assigned a doctorate in Rabbi Revel. But wow, and I think of Mrs. Revel and Rabbi Revel's son, whom I know, Norman, the other one was already dead, Heschel. And wow, but that's life. You find out it's like you want to show your great-grandparents what your great-grandchildren look like. And I hope in heaven they're looking down. And remember, my great-grandparents don't understand one word of my great-grandchildren. I have my own problems understanding them. They speak Hebrew so rapidly at the age of 2. They must be geniuses. It took me 50 years to learn modern Hebrew. And they're 2 years old, and wow. All right, let's sign off here. I have the furniture doctor at my house. I
gotta,
Shana Tova, I got to get home to pay the bill. Thanks, Lekulchem. Bracha v'hatzlacha and rak besorah tova. God bless you all. Love you. God, thanks, Charlie. Thanks. Okay. What is
it?
Thank you, Eliezer. Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you.